Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
At East County Magazine, our reporting is making a difference. Today, we have two good news updates to report. Recently, we told you about dark days at several rural fire stations in East County that were closed during fire season for days or even weeks at a time. Now, Captain Mike Moeller from CAL FIRE has informed us that the County Fire Authority, which partners with CAL FIRE, has authorized overtime pay to staff those stations. On October 28th, East County Magazine published a story citing numerous complaints from residents about near-miss head-on crashes on Highway 94. Drivers believe these were caused by lack of roadway striping during a Caltrans repaving project that's expected to last through the end of this year. Our story also noted a fatality accident on Highway 94, though CHP has said that alcohol may have been a factor in that particular crash. We also brought the residents' concerns about safety to the attention of Caltrans. Marcia Spurgeon works in an office on Highway 94 in Jamul. Last week, she wrote to us and to our news partner, 10 News, with this update. I cannot thank you both enough for writing and airing the serious and dangerous situation on Highway 94 in Jamul. Today, at approximately noon, a large truck parked in our office driveway. Within a half hour, we had not one or two, but three large white arrows in the westbound turn lane. The eastbound turn lane has two. She said that other areas are also being restriped on the highway. And she added, "Bravo to both of you. I honestly believe you have saved lives by bringing this to the public's attention." Reporting for East County Magazine on News in the Public Interest, this is Miriam Raftery. Should unmanned drone aircraft testing be allowed over San Diego and East County? With virtually no public notification, a plan to do just that has been rapidly moving forward at the federal and local levels. The proposed test area mapped out by Cal UAS Portal includes desert, mountain, and ocean areas from San Diego's coast all the way across East County, also encompassing portions of Imperial County. The area was recommended due to its diverse climate zones to provide testing in varying conditions. San Diego's entire congressional delegation supports this plan. All five members have signed a letter favoring efforts to have the Federal Aviation Administration declare our region an unmanned aircraft systems test site. Representatives Daryl Issa, Scott Peters, Juan Vargas, Susan Davis, and Duncan Hunter all signed the letter, which was sent to the U.S. Transportation Secretary and to an FAA manager. The letter states, "San Diego is a center of aerospace technology, and the region meets and or exceeds the criteria put forth by the FAA for the test site." San Diego supervisors in late September also directed county staff to write a letter in support of this. Supervisor Diane Jacob has said she supports the concept to provide numerous jobs as well as for wildfire monitoring. She has reportedly committed to schedule a town hall, though, for constituents to discuss the issue. Eileen Shibley, leader of the Cal UAS Portal team, called the support welcome news. The group is one of 25 teams in 24 states that are vying for one of six test site designations that the FAA will announce for the drone testing by year's end. Setting up test sites is the first step toward allowing unmanned aerial vehicles into U.S. airspace by the end of 2015, as Congress has directed the FAA to do. But now, a citizens' action group called Backcountry Voices has formed to oppose drone testing locally. The group plans two meetings at the Julian Library. The first is on November 11th at 6 p.m., Veterans Day, and the second is on December 4th at 6 p.m. to inform the public about risks involving drones. The opponents voice concerns over privacy over drone surveillance. Since the drones are equipped with cameras, safety is another concern if law enforcement is allowed to operate weaponized drones. There is also a danger of crashes, which could cause brush fires, and the more remote the location, the harder it is for firefighters to access. In addition, concerns over environmental impacts and interference with bird migrations have also been raised. According to David Loy, legal director of the American Civil Liberties chapter in San Diego and Imperial Counties, drones can threaten not only our privacy and civil liberties, but also even lives. Worldwide, thousands of innocent civilians have reportedly been killed by drones, including children. Dave Patterson, with San Diego Veterans for Peace, asked what will become of the surveillance information collected by the proposed 10,000 drones around Southern California. He concludes, our Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights are going to go up in a cloud of drones if we're not careful.
This is Leon Thompson.
And this is Jerry Dean.
Bringing you this week's local government report. Lemon Grove City Council meets on Tuesday, November 5th. This week, the agenda includes proposed locations for a dog park, an expert panel on community gardens, and a report on economic development challenges and opportunities in Lemon Grove.
San Diego supervisors meet on both Tuesday and Wednesday. On Tuesday, November 5th, the agenda includes proposals to streamline adoption procedures, obtain competitive bids for physical and mental health services and crisis counseling, and award a construction contract for the probation department's juvenile ranch facility and Camp Barrett staff housing. Supervisors will also consider approving in principle purchase of property for a future fire station on Palomar Mountain. On Wednesday, November 6, supervisors will hold public hearings on several East County issues. These include creation of underground utility districts in Lakeside and Ramona, as well as aviation leases at Gillespie Field and Borrego Airport. Acquisition of open space for Otay Valley Regional Park is also on Wednesday's agenda.
Looking ahead, on November 12th, El Cajon's council will be deciding who it will appoint to replace former Mayor Mark Lewis, who resigned for health reasons following a controversy over ethnic remarks that he made.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Effective November 1st, food stamp benefits to over 47 million Americans have been reduced. Benefits under the program, which is known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, were increased back in 2009 as part of President Obama's economic stimulus. That increase was not meant to be temporary. It was intended to cover cost of living increases over the next few years. But now, Congress has allowed that increase to expire. A family of four will lose $36 a month. A single recipient will now have to rely on just $1.40 per meal. The Farm Bill is now up for renewal, and congressional Republicans want to change requirements for food stamps to make it even harder to qualify, which will increase pressure on those who are poor and hungry. The cuts have also increased demand for food pantries, according to Feeding America. Now, for those in need locally, there is a list of food pantries available if you Google Feeding America San Diego. You can find locations across East County where you can get temporary food help, and we will also be putting a link to those at our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org. On a related note, this week on November 5th, the San Diego supervisors will be voting on a proposal to increase general relief, which is a state-mandated but county-funded public assistance program. This provides cash assistance to eligible low-income county residents who are not already getting other state or federal programs or resources. The proposal would increase the general relief grants for a single person to $303 and for a married couple at $413 a month.
This is Ed Barreno with East County Magazine and KNSJ with an announcement that volunteers are needed for the upcoming special municipal election to fill the vacancy left after elected Mayor Bob Filner resigned. Mail ballot voting and early voting is already taking place, and 572 polling places will be set up early Tuesday, November 19th in neighborhoods. Voting will take place on Election Day from 7 a.m. through 8 p.m. for the City of San Diego's 675,000 registered voters. If you speak Chinese or Vietnamese, the Registrar of Voters needs your help at local poll sites on November 19th. Registrar Michael Vu says there is an urgent need for more bilingual volunteers to help citizens who are not yet proficient in English to vote at the polls. Chinese and Vietnamese new poll worker orientation training classes are offered. Bilingual poll worker volunteers can earn a stipend of $90 to $110. All poll worker volunteers must be U.S. citizens registered to vote in California and able to read and write the English language. For questions about being a poll worker, where the polls will be located in the City of San Diego, or whether you're registered to vote, call 858-565-5800 or visit www.sdvote.com. Once again, that number, 858-565-5800 or sdvote.com.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Helix Water District's board on Wednesday will be considering options for the future of Lake Jennings. The popular recreational area in Lakeside has not been covering its costs and may face closure. On Wednesday, the board will vote on whether or not to have staff prepare detailed reports on four options for the future of Lake Jennings. One option would be to close the lake to the public and decommission all campgrounds and fishing facilities permanently. Option two would limit public access to only hiking, picnicking, and fishing, but the lake would no longer be stocked with fish. Campgrounds would be decommissioned. The third option would be to maintain camping and fishing and invest $1,600,000 to $3,600,000 in renovations. The fourth option would be to create a master plan for renovation and expansion that would cost between $8 million and $15 million, with additional expenses for permitting, environmental impact, and mitigation. A 2007 financial analysis indicated it would take 10 years for a net positive cash flow and another 10 years to break even on capital invested from the master plan. But a later review by that same expert who prepared the 2007 study concluded recently that those projections were optimistic and that return on investment may not occur during the useful life of the facilities. Board member Joel Galzetti has fought against closure of the facility. He told us that he wanted the board to set up an exploratory committee to keep the lake operating, but that the board has not taken his action. Some other recreational facilities in the region have private foundations that partner with public facilities to raise funds and awareness, such as Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation, Volcan Mountain Foundation, Lake Cuyamaca Foundation, and Palomar State Park Foundation. The latter can successfully raise over $72,000 to prevent closure of Palomar Mountain State Park during the state's budget crisis. As a follow-up to the Lake Jennings workshop held in September, staff proposes to provide the board with additional information on these four alternatives, including a five-year analysis for each alternative. The board meeting will be held this Wednesday, November 6th at 3 p.m. at the Helix Board Headquarters, 7811 University Avenue in La Mesa.
This is Ed Barenna with East County Magazine and KNSJ. The Helix Water District is turning 100 years old. The district will hold a centennial celebration on Wednesday at the Administration Office Boardroom at 7811 University Avenue in La Mesa on Wednesday, November 6th at 5 p.m. Strangely enough, the district started as a water district with no water. At first, it was a private business, the San Diego Flume Company. The district went public as a result of a vote taken in East County on November 1st, 1913 to become the La Mesa-Lemon Grove Spring Valley Irrigation District. Having no water sources of its own, it immediately began working to secure water for its potential East County customers. In 1926, after a number of previous attempts, the district finally purchased the water rights, facilities, and equipment of the Cuyamaca Flume Company, then owned and operated by Ed Fletcher, James A. Murray, and others. The last piece of the Redwood Flume which carried the water was taken out of service on November 1, 1937, but the flume rights of way are still part of the district's assets and remain in use today. After World War II, the district saw rapid expansion. It incorporated the El Cajon Valley Irrigation District and La Mesa Islands in the early 1950s. The district's name changed to Helix Irrigation District in 1953, and on March 7, 1973, the California legislature approved its final name change to Helix Water District. Today, the district serves 567,000 people in the East County communities of La Mesa, Lemon Grove, El Cajon, and Spring Valley, as well as small areas of Santee, Lakeside, and some of the unincorporated parts of the county. The district also holds a large historical archive of documents and photos. Many of these historic photos can be viewed in the Administration Building lobby, open Monday through Friday from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. The centennial commemoration again will be this Wednesday, November 6th at 5 p.m.
The Helix Water District Board is considering major changes to its policy governing actions of its board members. While some of the policies have positive goals, such as preventing conflicts of interest, critics say that other policy changes aim to silence dissenting voices on the board, punish whistleblowers, and potentially limit public testimony. The board has a troubling history in this regard. Last year, Helix Water Board member Chuck Muse sought to prohibit board members from speaking to the media shortly after an outspoken member criticized a proposed rate hike in the media interviews and drew angry responses from the board. The board stopped short of outlawing members from talking to the press back then, an action that probably would have been unconstitutional. Instead, the board voted to require its members to make clear that they are speaking as individuals, not representing the board's position when speaking to the press and public. This Wednesday, November 6th, however, the board agenda proposes new policies that would go much farther. While some policy changes aim to curb abuses by officials, others have a potential chilling effect on board members' free speech and the rights of the public to address this public board. The new policy, for example, would allow the board chair to set reasonable limits upon the length of time and numbers of occasions on which a member of the public may speak at meetings. While it's common for boards to set limits on how long any individual may speak, we are not aware of any other boards that restrict the number of times a member of the public may speak, and indeed, it is not unusual to see some impassioned members of the public speak during the public comment period at nearly every meeting, or on multiple agenda items within a single meeting. David Smiley, a frequent outspoken critic of the Helix Water District who has testified often at board meetings, had this to say about the new policy. "That doesn't sound very democratic." He indicated his intent to speak out against the policy change at Wednesday's meeting. Board member Joel Scalzitti served on the committee to draft the guidelines. He told us that the committee's intent with that clause was to allow flexibility for some members of the public to cede their time to others so that a group could make a presentation longer than 3 minutes. However, the language as drafted would also allow an individual's testimony to be restricted, so the board may wish to amend that language. Scalzitti said his goal in formulating the new board guidelines overall was to create some scope for the president, meaning to require that the board president shall act or speak for the full board and not for himself, and shall not meet with other agencies or public officials without the board's direction. Scalzitti had previously objected to Helix representatives meeting with Padre Dam Water District officials about a potential takeover of Lake Jennings without informing the rest of the board. Scalzitti has fought to keep the lake open and under Helix Water District ownership. The opening paragraph of the proposed guidelines for conduct curiously adds language suggesting that the interests of the public and the district are no longer the same, requiring board members to be, quote, responsive to the needs of the public and the district. Previously, only the public interest was listed. As for board members, the guidelines contain some language that, in the view of one longtime Helix Water Board attendee who asked not to be named, could mean that, quote, "The majority will be able to muzzle and punish the minority at will for perceived insults or differing opinions," unquote. For example, the new requirements would mandate that any time a board member has contact with a member of the media, they must notify the full board. Not only is this potentially intimidating, it also effectively would eliminate whistleblowing to the media if a board member should become aware of wrongdoing. The member would, however, still be free to speak with a grand jury. Moreover, the guidelines appear to prohibit members from voicing dissent with the majority after a vote is taken. The guideline reads, "Once the board takes action, board members should commit to supporting said action and not create barriers to implementation of said action." Does that mean that if a board member utters a dissenting opinion, they could be accused of undermining the district? If a reporter asks a member on the losing side about their opinion, is this now a punishable offense? Scalzitti, who has also been critical of some board members' actions, told our editor, "I think we should be able to talk to the press." He interprets the guideline as a courtesy notice when a board member speaks with a reporter, and he doesn't think that the rule requires members to divulge the full content of such conversations. The guidelines also empower the board majority to determine whether conduct is in violation of the new policies, and if so, to issue punishments that may range from a warning letter to removal of the board member from committees and even denial of their payment for per diem and expense reimbursements. Members are also required to answer questions, quote, "directly, telling the truth, and admitting to a lack of knowledge if applicable," unquote. But whose version of facts apply when there are competing statistics, and what is the criteria for determining who is knowledgeable? Board members are also required to disclose to the general manager any improper activities. One longtime board observer said of this, quote, forced coercion, that one is ignorant, or you might be financially punished. Fall in line and rubber stamp the general manager, or we'll punish you. The board meeting will be held at 3 o'clock on Wednesday, November 6, at Helix Water District's headquarters, 7811 University Avenue in La Mesa.
This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ. Five new cases of pertussis, also known as whooping cough, have been reported in area schools this week, according to the San Diego County Health and Human Services Agency. The new cases include a student at Maryland Avenue Elementary School in La Mesa here in East County. There have been 216 cases of pertussis reported in the county so far this year, compared to last year's total of 165 cases for the entire year. So the rate of whooping cough is on the rise. County health officials continue to remind parents to vaccinate their children, although all five new cases last week were among children who are up to date on their vaccines. Infants under 1 year old are especially vulnerable because they do not have the full five-dose series of pertussis vaccinations. Parents can obtain the vaccine series and the booster shot for themselves and their children through their primary care physicians. Local retail pharmacies offer vaccinations for a fee, and anyone who is not covered by a medical insurance plan can get the shot from a county public health center at no cost. A typical case of pertussis starts with a cough and runny nose, followed by weeks to months of rapid coughing fits that sometimes end with a whooping sound. Fever, if persistent, is usually mild. The disease is treatable with antibiotic, but can cause death if left untreated.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
I'm Leon Thompson, and today I'm here with Miriam Raftery, the editor of East County Magazine. Nine East County Magazine team members combined to win 11 awards in San Diego Press Club's Excellence in Journalism Awards, presented October 29th. East County Magazine has won a total of 58 journalism awards since launching in 2008. So, Miriam, who are this year's winners?
I want to congratulate everybody on our team. We're very proud of them. And in alphabetical order, our winning team members are Nadine Abbott, Park Ewing, Paul Cruz, Brian Lafferty, Ron Logan, Jim Pelly, myself, Miriam Raftery, Sierra Robinson, and Darren Sefcik.
What are some of the winning topics?
Well, our winning news entries dealt mainly with those compelling public health and safety issues, wildfires and industrial-scale energy projects primarily, although we also picked up some awards for photography, feature writing, commentary, and one of our columnists also won. We also took a first place for multicultural reporting, and that was for our story about the Native American Heritage Commission declaring Ocotillo Wind a sacred site and chronicling the ordeal that the Native Americans have had in dealing with the federal government over this wind project.
So what are some of the energy issues that you've covered?
We've done a lot of stories on wind energy that won awards. Some of the titles were The Betrayal of Boulevard, Can This Happen to Your Town Too?, An Ill Wind Blowing, that was an editorial that I wrote, Where is the Wind?, which took second place in investigative reporting, and Wind Turbines Arrive in Ocotillo as Residents Complain of Dust Bowl and Third World Conditions. I'm also especially proud of one of our interns, Sierra Robinson, this year won an award along with Nadine Abbott and myself for a series on wind energy issues called Supervisors Blow Off Residents' Concerns Over Wind Ordinance. And that was all about how the residents were bringing up information about health information and serious risks posed by these projects. And yet, four of the five supervisors, Supervisor Jacob being the notable exception there, but the other four voted to enact a wind ordinance that would allow these industrial-scale turbines in rural areas, basically ignoring many serious concerns.
Tell us about the winning stories on fire issues.
Yeah, we had one that was about the 1,900 acres of wilderness that were scorched in the San Felipe fire. And that was a controlled burn that actually went out of control and raised a lot of interesting questions. Plus, we picked up an award for a story on how the Palomar Mountain Volunteer Fire Department is fighting back against a county takeover of the rural fire departments.
You mentioned that you had photography awards. Tell me about that.
Ron Logan is one of our photographers, and he actually took first place in the Still Photography News category for an image he shot of the Space Shuttle Endeavour's final journey. It wasn't East County, but it was an amazing image, so we ran it anyway in our Photos of the Week. Darren Sefcik took third place for his photo, Counting Sheep on the Annual Bighorn Count in the Anza Borrego Desert, and one of those photos of his sheep also won a first place in another photo contest recently that we sponsored.
So which one of your columnists picked up an award?
We're very proud of Brian Lafferty, who's our movie reviewer. He picked up an honor for his On the Silver Screen review of the movie Before Midnight.
Oh, congratulations. Who won the most awards?
Well, on an individual basis, actually, I got 8 awards, and that was tied for the most awards received by any single journalist this year. Now, you can go online, and you can read all of our winning entries at eastcountymagazine.org. And if you want to see the winning entries by other publications around town, as well as TV and radio station entries, you can go to the San Diego Press Club site.
Thank you, Miriam, and congratulations to you and your crew.
It's been a team effort, and we really appreciate it. And this is also a good time to mention that we are always looking for community volunteers that we can train. Many of these people that won awards were not professional journalists. Some of them are. Others are citizen journalists that we've helped to train.
The West Coast is taking the lead in the battle against climate change. California Governor Jerry Brown and the governors of Oregon and Washington joined with a Canadian province official this week to sign a pledge to coordinate their global warming policies. Earth Justice President Trip Van Nopen says the agreement will help create a bigger market for the kinds of steps he believes the rest of the country and world should be taking.
Like a bigger market for low-carbon fuels and electric vehicles, a bigger market for trading carbon credits and for seeing the implementation of a price on carbon as they have in British Columbia.
The three states and the Canadian province have 53 million people and a combined gross domestic product of $2.8 trillion, which is the fifth largest economy in the world. California already has a cap-and-trade program in place, and BC has a carbon tax. Van Nopen says the pledge is a great example of some states across two countries deciding to lead rather than wait on a federal or global climate agreement.
By joining together and really building the renewable energy economy, they're demonstrating that much more emphatically, and that's a message that the rest of the United States can learn as well from this agreement.
Van Nopen says the states and British Columbia are also proving that sufficient power can be produced without the use of coal.
That's the kind of initiative that we need more of, and it's wonderful to see here on the West Coast.
The deal was put together by the Pacific Coast Action Plan on Climate and Energy. It also supports new rules from the Obama administration that sets limits on carbon emissions from new power plants, which some predict will mean the end of any new coal-fired plants. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. We have some Veterans Day activities for you this week, as well as some fall events up in Julian. The City of El Cajon invites the public to join in the Centennial Farewell Festivities on Tuesday, November 12th at the Centennial Plaza at 200 Civic Center Way from 12 to 3 p.m. This farewell celebration also includes a special tribute to our veterans, including the VFW, AMVETS, Navy Fleet Reserve, the American Legion, and the Marine Corps League Detachment, Color Guard Presentation of Colors will also be performed. They will recognize those who have volunteered more than 100 hours in the El Cajon community, symbolizing the 100-year centennial that's been celebrated all year in El Cajon. Campo Creek Vineyards will be hosting the second annual Bocce Ball Tournament at Campo Creek Vineyards this Saturday, November 9th. Campo Creek Vineyards will supply hamburgers, sausages, rolls, utensils, condiments, soda, and water, and guests are asked to bring side dishes or desserts. For the fourth consecutive year, College Avenue Baptist Church will host a free neighborhood fall festival on its expansive campus near the intersection of College Avenue and El Cajon Boulevard. The Saturday, November 9th festival is from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. and will feature more than 15 fun carnival games, including a small fry basketball shooting contest, a pumpkin ring toss, puppet shows, and a giant fish tank for catching candy and prizes. Entertainment includes a bluegrass band and optical illusions and comedy from Looney Dooney. The festival also includes a free lunch, crafts for a variety of skill levels, face painting, and much more. The festival takes place, rain or shine, inside the College Avenue Baptist Church Family Center and Gymnasium. There is no admission charge and plenty of free parking. The California Art Club and Olaf Wighorst Museum are hosting a juried art show that began on October 8th and will run through January 11th, 2014, at the Olaf Wighorst Museum's downtown El Cajon location on Rhea Avenue. Two guest lectures will be featured during the show. On Thursday, November 14th at 6:30 p.m., Mark Fellman will speak on Capturing San Diego's Nature, 100 Years of Landscape Painting. And on December 5th at 6:30 p.m., Ross Provance will reminisce about the life and art of El Cajon's most famous Western artist, Danish-born Olaf Wighorst. The museum is open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And they are also presenting a champagne luncheon and festive Chinese auction on Saturday, November 9th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Guests can celebrate the holidays at the Wighorst Museum at this event, which includes a sit-down luncheon at 12:15. The event requires an RSVP. The Lemon Grove Historical Society will present a special edition of History Alive on Thursday, November 7th at 7 p.m. in the H. Lee House Cultural Center in Lemon Grove, when theater pros Anne Charlotte and Michael Harvey recall in words, music, and images their production of the four-act melodrama The Drunkard, presented during the glory days of the Lemon Grove Players. At that time, a platoon of volunteers presented everything from melodrama to Molière in local school auditoriums for the next 5 years. History Alive is free and suitable for ages 13 and over. Refreshments will follow the presentation. Now for some Veterans Day activities. Grossmont College and Cuyamaca College are celebrating an entire week of commemorative activities for our veterans. Grossmont and Cuyamaca Colleges are planning these activities on both campuses and a couple of off-campus events starting Monday, November 4th through Thursday, November 8th. More than 2,000 veterans a year enroll at these two East County colleges. Grossmont College's events include the Wind Talkers film, shown on Wednesday, November 6th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Griffin Gate in the Student Center. Wind Talkers was the code given to the Navajo Indian Code Talkers, employed by the U.S. military intelligence during World War II. Following the film, Ivan Sam, grandson of one of the original Code Walkers, will speak. There will be an American Indian Warrior Association presentation on Wednesday, November 6th from 6 to 9 p.m. in Building 26, Room 220. Also on that same day, Wednesday, a self-defense seminar will be held from 11 a.m. to noon on the football field. This is a free one-hour self-defense seminar where participants will learn awareness and basic principles to ward off an attack in various settings and scenarios. Space is limited and participants must sign up. Then on Thursday, November 7th, there will be a screening of the film Bring It Home and a veterans art expose from 2 to 5 p.m. on the first floor of the Student Center. During this week of events, the VA's Vet Center mobile unit will be in the main quad. A POW table will be set up at the Student Center to honor service members who are missing in action or prisoners of war. Cuyamaca College's veterans events include a community service project to collect warm clothing to pass out to homeless veterans. On Wednesday, November 6th, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on the Grand Lawn, the mobile vet center just mentioned will be set up. This is actually a customized vehicle that is equipped with confidential counseling space and a state-of-the-art communications package to provide VA benefits assistance, referrals for medical issues, employment assessment, and more right on site. On Thursday, November 7th, from noon to 1 p.m., there will be a reboot workshop in the Student Center, I-104. Reboot is a program that is designed to address veteran transition issues at their root cause and assist veterans and recently separated service women and men from the military to civilian world by providing them with a three-phase intensive cognitive behavioral education reintegration program. This November, Bellis Academy is also helping veterans for three straight days as it presents a variety of freebies for military mamas, wives, and of course, service members. From November 12th through 15th, Bellis offers gratis services for military members and their family with a valid military ID with the following services: manicure, brow wax, haircut, pumpkin peel, and pomegranate facial with makeup touch-up. These services can be redeemed at the Poway and El Cajon locations, and some services are also available at their National City location. A Music of the Masters Chamber Music Concert will be presented in Alpine on Saturday, November 9th at 3 p.m. at Christ the King Episcopal Church on Midway Drive in Alpine. The concert includes a wine and cheese reception with artists following the concert, a silent auction, and art display. Tickets are required. You Missed is a new comedy program packed with humor, lots of strange stories from around the world, political perspectives from the right, left, and people that just don't give a darn. You Missed is recording live at the Space Bar in La Mesa on Sunday nights from 6 to 7 p.m. The show will air on KNSJ 89.1 Community Radio, Network for Social Justice, Friday to Sunday at 4 p.m., streaming worldwide on www.knsj.org. You Missed podcast will be coming soon. Taste of the Summit 2013 in Warner Springs takes place Saturday, November 9th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Wine lovers are invited to taste wines from five wineries of the North Mountain Wine Trail area. The event will pair wines with a full menu of gourmet foods, and live music will be provided at each site. The participating wineries are La Serenissima, Oran, Shadow Mountain, Hawkwatch, and Sierra Roble. The wineries are all within 2 miles of each other. Pancake Breakfast at the Descanso Town Hall will be held on Saturday, November 9th. This event is held at the Descanso Town Hall, which is a historic building in Descanso. Then on Friday, November 8th at 7 p.m., West Hills High School's next theater production, John Lennon and Me, will be performed. This show features favorite Beatles songs and is family-friendly. Show dates are November 8th, 9th, 15th, and 16th. Show start at 7 p.m., and children and students and adults are all welcome. With fall season, many of us love to visit the Julian area, so here is a quick preview of some of Julian's weekend events. Every Sunday, weather permitting, the Julian Doves and Desperados perform historic comedy skits at 1 p.m., 2 p.m., and 3 p.m. in the stage area between the Julian Fitness Center and the Julian Market in Delhi. Every Saturday, Bailey Barbecue features live music at 8 p.m. They are located on the corner of Main and A Street. Every Friday, live entertainment is performed at the Pine Hills Lodge Pub from 8 p.m. to 12 midnight. And on Sundays, guests can enjoy music at the Marketplace, a year-round family-friendly event with live local music and barbecue at Winola Farms Marketplace. That's it for this week. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and in our festival and events section at eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly.
It's Leon Thompson, and I'm here with Raylene Nicole, a promising young musician from East County. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Yeah, so I grew up my whole life in East County, my whole 18 years of life. We've moved around a lot, but basically it's been the same two freeway exits the whole time. I went to elementary school, middle school, Boston Valley, and then Las Coches Creek, and then I went to high school, Granite Hills, and I just graduated.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, I first heard you at the Coyote Music Festival at Cuyamaca College. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was a really fun experience. It was the first music festival I've ever been a part of, and I had no idea that I was actually going to be in that. And one day, I was at Starbucks in Rancho San Diego. They have an open mic, so I was at the open mic. Then I happened to walk in to grab a Starbucks, and on the little bulletin board, they had like a little flyer saying, oh, musicians need it. I'm like, oh, that's me. I think it was a website, and I looked on and it was the music festival, and I'm like, that would be super cool. And they were having tryouts, so I went to the tryouts, and it was really intimidating because I walked in and I was still a senior in high school, so it's all these college kids in this big giant like performance hall, so, like with a stage and chairs, like theater looking. And so I was on the stage all by myself, me and my guitar, and then all these people in the seats. Part of their class was to judge the auditions, so they're all staring at me with papers, writing down notes. I had no idea what they were writing, and they're all looking up at me every now and then. And then I started playing, and one guy in the front, I remember, was like dancing to it, so I felt a lot better. I was like, okay, they like it. I'm not gonna die. So, and then I think they emailed me or called me back. They really liked your audition. We'd like to have you play at the festival. So my drummer, Chemo, and I just got together, practiced a little bit, came up with the set, and then we got to play, and it was so much fun. It was the coolest thing. It was, you know, it was a really nice day, so everyone was out there on blankets, like with picnics, and there was like tons of little booths around, and I think it was only their second or third annual. It was really new, so I'm sure it's going to even get bigger and bigger every year. So the students were running everything. That's a really cool class, you know, to teach kids to run a festival. That's something that you don't learn every day. There was a lot of other musicians and bands, and they had face painting. I got to get my face painted and snow cones and just little vendors and everything. So it was a really cool way to bring the whole college area community together.
Speaking of your music, how would you describe it?
I would describe my music as like a relaxing summer playlist, you know, when you're driving in the car. I have some upbeat songs that really get people going. I'm a typical teenage girl, so what else am I going to write about rather than, you know, the boy I have a crush on or something? So a lot of my songs are about that kind of feeling when you don't really know the person too well, but you can't wait to see what happens in the future. And that's, I think that's one of the funnest feelings ever, is like the feeling of possibility or who knows what's going to come. You know, I really like this guy and he, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I like him. That's all I know. I have a couple other ones. They're also upbeat, and I'm trying to write more of these songs lately because it's how I feel, and it's more just about believing in yourself and not really listening to negative people, or, you know, just positive sort of things, and just about good feelings, and sounds like rainbows, butterflies kind of thing. But, you know, I like that. So I like inspiring people to believe in themselves and go for what they really want to do rather than just be sad. But then on the other hand, I do have a couple sad songs that are extremely sad. So, but I think that's kind of what I like to make myself relatable, saying, you know, I understand how they feel, or like certain feelings that people don't like to touch on. But if the lyrics can understand how they're feeling, I think people like that and they'll relate to that and want to listen to that more. Yeah.
Can you do one of your songs for us?
Yes, I can. Is that the one
Pouring
I just...
Down.
Yes, I can.
All right. Thank you. Let's hear that.
So much more I haven't told you. There's so much more that you don't everything's so new, but just trust me and I'll trust you. I've still got so much more of me to show. You've got those eyes that make me wonder. I wonder if you feel the way I do. Now I can't concentrate in. It's your fault, I can't think straight. Just tell me if your hands are shaking too. We're not too sure about anything, but honestly for me, that's okay. Kiss me in the rain out where it's pouring down, but I don't care, I'm giving up and I'm so scared. So beautiful when I'm with you, the way we laugh on accident. I think I'm going under as we dance to the flash of thunder. We're so cool, we won't go inside just yet. We're not too sure about anything, but honestly for me, that's okay.
Well, thank you, Rayleigh.
You're welcome.
So what's coming up in your career? What is next for Rayleigh?
The next thing I really want to do is record a full album, 12-song album, mix of, you know, happy and sad ones. I still need a couple more songs before I do that, but I want to record that album, kind of tour around the country, kind of the poor musicians tour where I, you know, get in my own car and drive around, but hey, a tour is a tour. Just spread the music and see, you know, how far I can get it to go.
How did you get your musical training?
I have been taking piano lessons ever since I was 5 years old, and then I went all the way until high school started, so up till I was 15, so it was 10 years of piano lessons, and then I did, I think, like a week or two of vocal lessons when I was in middle school or something, and I didn't like it very much, and then even back then, I wasn't trying to sing, I just went to lessons just because, but I never really started singing until after my freshman year in high school, and that's when I started playing guitar as well, because my grandparents got me a guitar for Christmas during my freshman year, and then I didn't really do much with it, I learned a couple chords, and then that was that, and then then after my freshman year of high school, during that summer, I think I put up my first YouTube video and all my friends were like, oh my God. Now I look back on it and I'm like, oh, that was not very good at all. But back then, I mean, I got tons of praise for it. So I was like, okay, if I can hide on the computer screen and they like it, now I can go in person and maybe they'll like it too. So I started to play covers at local coffee shops and things like that in South Park and North Park, City Heights area. I started writing originals and playing those. And then that got me to go up and produce the EP and everything. And I never took any guitar lessons. It was really just, if you really, really want to learn something, you'll figure out a way to teach yourself. You will learn it. And especially today with the internet, it was so easy. I was on YouTube all the time. UltimateGuitar.com was a blessing because once you learn how to read, because I used the book to teach myself to read chords and tab. And then once I could do that, I could get on Ultimate Guitar. And then each song had chords and tabs with it. And I was like, okay, well, now I can play the song. I would play it like 5 hours a day, like so much. And so I think I learned quickly. It kind of kickstarted a lot of time. I compacted it into one summer. But yeah, I never took lessons. I just used YouTube videos and online everything. So.
We're really glad that you did.
Thanks.
your voice is lovely and sweet.
Thank you.
And I like your chord progressions and changes and the range. It's just beautiful. So
thank
really
you so
appreciate
much.
You coming in
Thank
and
you.
Talking to us.
Thanks.
We've been speaking to Raylee Nicole. So how can people reach you if they want to hear some more of your music?
Well, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all those social network things that everyone likes to go on. Just look up Raylee Nicole, which is R-A-E-L-E-E. That's Raylee. And then Nicole is N-I-K-O-L-E. And then I have a website, www.RayleeNicole.com, www.RayleeNicole.com.
Thank you so much, Raylee.
This is Janice Morgan, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world. This is Janice Mork. I'm here with Robert Coleman, the executive director of the Second Chance Program, which deals with the hard-to-serve population, formerly incarcerated, former substance abusers, the homeless vets, and the at-risk youth. Can you tell me how you came to work with the Second Chance Program?
Sure. I came to work at Second Chance Program just 3 years ago. I spent my entire career in England working with housing young people and with Celtic Lifestyles and getting them back into work and employment. And so working at Second Chance is a real thrill for me as we work to get the hardest to serve, homeless, the veterans, people who have just come out of incarceration, people who may be using drug or alcohol or have that addiction in their lives and are moving on from that, and just helping them get back into work and full-time employment again.
Wow, very nice. And can you tell the listeners more about the Second Chance's history?
Second Chance has been around now for 20 years. This is our 20th birthday just this year, and we have a gala on the October the 5th to celebrate that event. And so in all of those years, we have been serving people through housing and job readiness training programs and helping them get back into full-time employment. And certainly since 2003, when we started collecting electronic records, we've got nearly 4,000 people back into work over those years.
Wow, what an amazing accomplishment. And how do you get word out about your programs here, and how are people referred to you?
People are referred to us in all sorts of ways. Many people come to Second Chance through referral from friends, family members. We work a lot with the sheriff and the probation departments, and so those colleagues will often refer people to Second Chance too. We have a large network of agencies that we work with throughout the county, and you know, we have an enviable reputation for getting some of the hardest to serve individuals back into employment, and working with these partnerships and these individuals along with getting word out through families and friends is a really key way for us to recruit people to Second Chance.
Okay. And your mission is to empower people to change their lives. Would you be willing to share a story of how Second Chance has accomplished this?
Sure, there are many stories to tell, but this one in particular that I'm going to share with you is the story of Angie. Angie was born a heroin addict. Her mother was a heroin addict, and when Angie came into the world, she too was suffering from that addiction as a baby. At the age of 16, Angie started injecting herself with heroin, and for the next 20 years, that was her lifestyle, in and out of prison and using drugs all the time. Angie came out of prison and was determined that her life was going to change around, was at a local residential program and someone has told her about Second Chance, and so she found her way to us. She graduated, and her first job upon graduation, just a few weeks later, was at Vons as a backpacker. But, you know, she was the best backpacker Vons had ever had. And people noticed her attention to detail and her attention to serving the customers, and an opportunity came up to become a trainee in the department. And so people said that you've not been here long enough to apply for it and you're unlikely to be successful. She put in a request and she was successful in getting the offer. And so Angie then trained to become a master butcher for Vons and graduated some months later with that qualification. Today, fast forwarding, she is the highest paid union employee at Vons at the La Jolla store. And she thoroughly enjoys using the skills that she's learned in the butchery department, serving the residents and the community there.
Okay, very cool. And can you give the listeners more details about the Strive program?
The four-week program that we provide to adults, like Angie, she went through it, is 160 hours. It's Monday to Friday at 9 to 5. It's pretty tough in that we have a high expectation of what people need to achieve to pass. You know, the expectations that we set are only those that employers expect. And so we set those standards right here at Second Chance so that when people do get back out into the workplace, there's no surprises to them in terms of attitude and behavior. The 4 weeks is in two parts. The first 2 weeks is we deal solely with people's attitude and their approach to work. We deal with little things like body language, how to approach someone and shake their hand, how to smile, to look at them in the eye, and to speak with confidence. And then the last 2 weeks, we focus on some of the more detailed work refinement skills, like resume building. We do lots of mock interviews with them. How to use the internet for research prior to an interview. Maybe some of the people that we work with don't have an email address, so we'll teach them how to use email, Outlook, Word, etc. All of the IT skills that they need to do to be successful, because so often these days, you know, there is to apply for jobs, you have to apply online. And so we teach people who maybe don't have those skills how to be successful.
Very good. And what can the public do to help?
You know, there are many ways that we need the support of individuals. So much of what we do is unfunded. And so it is only through the blessings and gifts that we receive from individuals who support Second Chance through gifts and donations that we're able to provide a Second Chance. So that's one way. And people can make donations via our website. We are pleased to be able to always welcome employers to come to Second Chance who help with the mock interviews. It's always great for us to have HR professionals come along and actually conduct these mock interviews themselves. It creates just the best real-life situation for our graduates to learn how to cope with an interview situation when, frankly, you're sitting in front of a stranger. And then there are many other ways. One other way is we provide business clothing to our graduates. Many of them don't have any form of decent clothing that they could use for an interview situation. And so we have suits and ties and trousers and everything that is necessary to be able to fully equip an individual to be ready for that interview situation. And there are volunteer opportunities that we have with PR and marketing and fundraising. So there are many ways that people join our family and support what we do.
Very cool. I just interviewed Robert Coleman, Executive Director of the Second Chance Program. You can find out more by visiting the website www.secondchanceprogram.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.